Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It's probably the longest roller coaster ride that I know anyone has ever endured.
John Kavalik is president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council, talking about Cuban relations.
It has a tremendous amount of peaks and valleys. It has some great moments, some horrible moments, some very scary moments. And in my case, I'm still not off the ride. I'm proud of what the organization has done during these 30 years. We've led in a lot of areas, but there, like anything, there's some disappointments.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Let's hope so.
Tom Sell is with Combest Sell and Associates, answering the question of whether we'll get a new farm bill.
Congress is coming back today. In fact, this is Monday, and they're back in Washington, D.C. for a three-week little press here before October. In October, they'll go home, big election cycle, of course, the presidential, and of course, every member of the House has to get reelected, and a third of the Senate every 2 years. And so everyone will be going home for elections, and then presumably they'll come back for a lame duck session after the elections and before the new Congress is seated. So limited, I guess, days to work and to try and attach the farm bill or a, extension plus type of package to address kind of the declining farm economy, limited days to actually get that done. But I feel like there is some momentum. And so a lot of farm groups are, just as you said, coming into D.C. today. They're going to be, before harvest. We're starting to get a little cooler fall weather. But a lot of farmers are taking time out just to come out and speak to kind of the urgency of the need in farm country. The fact that as prices had climbed incredibly over the last couple of years for the input costs, the production costs, the cost of production to bring a crop to harvest. And they've remained sticky now in the face of what are pretty steep declines in crop prices. It's really creating a massive squeeze for so many farm families across the U.S. from corner to corner. Corn, beans, wheat, cotton, rice. They're all coming to D.C. this week to try and press this need.
Sell is a farm policy expert with Combest Sell and Associates. He actually was part of writing the 2002 Farm Bill. At the end of the day, though, this one is past due.
Way past due. Yeah, this was, the previous Farm Bill, the 18 Farm Bill, which was kind of deemed insufficient from the start, right? Even in 2019, right after the 18 Farm Bill was passed, you started layering in the Trump aid payments, the trade war MFP style payments, which were in a way just an admission that the 18 Farm Bill didn't have a strong enough safety net. You had a number of payments go out in 19, 20, 21, 22. You were supposed to have a Farm Bill in 23 to kind of improve that safety net. And there was a lot of agreement on the need to do that. Of course, Congress couldn't get the job done in 2023. And look, it's always difficult. We'll come back to that. It's always a gauntlet. But they couldn't get the job done in 23, so they extended it. Now we're in the 24 crop year. They're certainly trying to get it done. And the Farm Bill will expire as of September 30th. There's kind of limited applicability to that. So it's not like we just fall off of a cliff. But the Farm Bill programs do, in fact, expire September 30th. And so there's a giant need again, this time in the face of the declining farm economy. So we are way past due on this Farm Bill. There has been a lot of good work put into it, Tony, over the last couple of years, as you know. A lot of, champs like G.T. Thompson, who's actually moved a bill through committee, a good bipartisan compromise that I think farmers across the country can look at and say, yeah, that would be a huge, huge help in the face of this downturn. So there's been good work, but man, you've got to bring it home, and we only have limited days to do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And I realize we're not at 9% inflation, but we're not nowhere near what we were from 2016 to 2020 when inflation was, quite frankly, was almost non-existent.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
And they can debate all they want what caused it, but if you really do a root cause analysis, and that's the only way you do proper problem solving, to figure out what the real problem, what is the root of this issue, it really comes back to bad executive branch policy. And it starts on day one of the Biden administration when they demonized domestic production of natural resources. And when they did that, even before the ink was dry on the executive orders, just what that did to with the speculators, it drove up the cost of diesel fuel, of propane, of gasoline, home heating fuel, impacting not just farmers, but all families, and really was a primary driver. And then on top of that, just the reckless spending, programs that were advanced in a partisan way by Democrats, trillions of dollars, and that excess of money flowing into the economy.
In addition, Brad Lubin, extension policy specialist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says labor and immigration issues.
But we've been dealing with these kinds of issues for many, many years, whether it's through legal immigration or through legal worker programs like H-2A, temporary worker, guest worker type programs, or whether it's how we deal with illegal immigration and undocumented immigrants and workers. Those are the same issues we've been dealing with, and we still haven't resolved them. There have been bipartisan efforts to try and identify solutions, or at least proposals, and yet there's not been any real movement towards a pragmatic or a consensus direction. Much like some of the other policy, it's easier to stand on principle and campaign about what is what you stand for or what you promise than it is to campaign on what actually gets delivered. And we always think that, well, in a non-election year, we can actually get through this. We haven't yet. Mm-hmm. One can hope that we find a way through it in the coming year.
But what happens if you lose risk management tools?
Typically, we would think of the Farm Bill as, well, that's where we have a safety net, and a safety net helps producers manage risk. And it's certainly true. The commodity program, the crop insurance program, disaster assistance programs all help producers manage some risk in agriculture. But it's also true to note that all of these policy issues, whether you talk about trade or taxes or labor and immigration or environment and climate issues or the Farm Bill itself, the uncertainty of whether we will go this direction with policy or that direction with policy or whether we will get it done or not get it done presents a risk of itself. And so producers have to manage not just for this year and this year's set of programs and rules and tax policies and so forth. Producers have to make long-run decisions about their operations that include the risk of what's the policy environment look like for the next decade or longer. And so policy itself is a risk, and managing for risk means using the tools and the programs that help you manage for today. It also means positioning your operations so that it can be successful despite whatever path forward we might end up taking. How do you manage for potential alternatives in future trade policy? That might change what kinds of commodities you grow. It might change what kind of markets you pursue. How do you manage for potential changes in tax policy? How can you position your operation to be ready for what may or may not come down the road? That's the risk of policy itself. It's the uncertainty and dealing with how do you manage for alternative scenarios.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So we're making the case for expanded utilization of higher blends, and it's working.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
But it's not just the domestic market that we cared about. You know, the reality is the rest of the world needs this stuff too. So we put resources behind and are supporting this industry to export ethanol. We recently announced the establishment of the Regional Agriculture Promotion Program, which is a trade promotion program designed to provide resources to groups and organizations, allowing them to do a better job of going into markets other than sort of the top four markets that we sell most of our ag stuff to, and trying to diversify our market opportunities in places like Vietnam and the Philippines and places like that. So We announced $1 billion from the Commodity Credit Corporation set aside, and we recently announced that we're rolling them out in tranches of $300 million. We did a tranche last year. We funded 66 organizations. We just recently announced the availability of the next $300 million. But in that the first tranche of $300 million, we basically provided $2.4 million to support the ethanol industry and its efforts to promote exports, which is why we've had record exports of ethanol. We saw the Philippines embrace an E20 blend rate. We saw Colombia restore its E10 mandate. We saw Japan increase its blend rate and also entered into an agreement to look at ways in which we could promote their sustainable aviation fuel opportunity. And, of course, we worked with our friends to the north in Canada to make sure that our fuel would be consistent with its clean fuel regulation, all of that leading to more exports.
Well, going from trade promotion to trade policy, Brad Lubin, University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
We talk about farm bills all the time, and it's quite possible with the ramifications of this year's election that the farm bill is a relatively minor item on the horizon in terms of what could really impact agriculture. And one of the first of those is trade. And it's not so much that the two campaigns differ dramatically on trade. It's that neither of them seems to be preaching trade negotiations and multilateral trade agreements and systems as a path forward. The Vice President Harris, as part of the current Biden-Harris administration, has championed or at least has pushed toward some multilateral negotiations and discussions, but mostly about geopolitical relationships and sort of trade relationships, not about improving trade access, particularly through reduced tariffs and other improved access. The Trump administration in its previous go-round in the White House focused on trade, not through many multilateral agreements, but mostly through confrontation and direct negotiation with competing countries to try and reach new agreements and promises of access and purchases. So neither candidate looks like they would pursue the traditional path of trying to grow trade through multilateral agreements and negotiations. It's a much less certain framework for what future trade opportunities might look like, even at a time when trade balances have actually turned negative and there's more pressure on U.S. ag exports than there's been previously.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The number one challenge is that I wake up every day knowing that something's going to go wrong. I don't know when, but I know it is.
Well, that's got to be a fun job. John Kavalik is president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council.
And I know that it's going to derail a lot of work that a lot of people have done prior to that day. And that's what's most frustrating, because over... You know, now what is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This is our 7th president that we've worked with each of them, and we've had successes in each one. But I always know that I can count on the government of Cuba to do something at some point that's going to derail those efforts and impact a tremendous amount of people, particularly those in the agricultural commodity field and the food product field. And, you know, the agricultural, I'll call it the agricultural lobby, the farm, you know, the farm groups and that, they've done the heavy lifting and, you know, during these last 30 years. And so that's what's frustrating is I always know something bad is going to happen. And I really wish that wasn't the case.
So why would you keep doing it?
My mantra years ago, you know, maybe 2 decades ago, used to be that those near 11 million people in Cuba had one of the highest awarenesses of U.S. brand names and preferences for U.S. brand names in the world. So if you're a U.S. company, it's a no-brainer. You've got a domestic marketplace that probably knows who you are and knows what you do and wants you there. But over time, it vacillates in terms of the energy, the ability to keep putting the energy in. It vacillates from wanting to do what's right, wanting to represent the interests of U.S. companies, want to help the Cuban people. But then sometimes it's due to spite. You get so angry at the Cubans, at the Cuban government, for what just seems like just incredible, a lack of vision and downright stupidity in terms of their decisions. And so you start to turn that, all right, I'm going to continue to do this because I'm doing it for spite, no longer to help. It's really to punish, even though I know the outcome is a good outcome. I'm not going to let them off the hook. I'm going to keep at them. And the same sometimes has been said, you know, in terms of working with the U.S. government over 30 years, have a lot of no's. But, you know, like that Energizer, you know, bunny in the commercials, just don't give up. Just keep coming back. Keep refining the argument. And wait. So that's, you know, in terms of, you know, why keep doing it? Cause I do think it makes sense and the efforts overall, are important and those successes are important. The failures are good, are instructive too, but it, you know, I still feel, connected to the goal and objective of the council. And so, even though sometimes it's difficult, you know, I stay with it.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Feeder cattle start up the Labor Day have been really kind of middle in the week, and then we've ended on kind of a down note at about 2:30 on the October contract. And really, there's just been a level of resistance where we shouldn't be going much lower, but the market's trying to figure out what's going to pull these prices higher into the fall.
Elliot Dennis is a livestock economist at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Especially since we generally have a kind of a seasonal decline in the cutout. And so our consumer is going to be spending more. So I think some of that's already being passed through. But part of that is also, I think, weaker pasture conditions and kind of an anticipation that we're going to have more feeder cattle brought to the market a little bit earlier and at different times. And so some of that market is being priced in. Generally, we track about 12 different states that make up the feeder cattle index, and all but two states had down weeks as far as pricing goes. Volumes were strong, but the exception, one of those was Nebraska. Generally, our 5-6 weights, they've been going down for several weeks, and they rebounded actually quite aggressively to almost $3.40 a pound. So that was a positive here in Nebraska. Our 7-8 weights were kind of leveled out. We had been declining for several weeks at about 260. But even at that 260 price a pound, we're still at historically high basis levels. So if we look at where we're at in the cash market, where we could be going into the fall, and where we're at in the futures, we're expecting a plus 30 basis. So that's very, very high. And even on our 5-6 weights, we're at about a plus 70, plus 75 basis. So this would be near all-time highs of basis levels. So really just an appreciation that we already have really strong prices to where we're at. And then with the anticipation of kind of further herd rebuilding in the fall or this coming fall and winter, you know, we could have significantly higher prices even in 2025. But one way that we can look at this is we can take kind of what the volatility is in the feeder cattle market, and we can look at kind of where that price level is and look at a lot of options data. And when we kind of can put that together, we get kind of a price estimate, and we can look at the distribution of prices or the range of what those prices would be. And right now, that 260 price, that's the historical basis plus the futures price, we're about 50%, which means 50% of the time, we're probably going to be a little bit higher than this price, and 50%, we're probably going to be a little bit lower. So I'd say the market's actually priced pretty accurately right now. And there's not a lot of downside or upside risk in that. So kind of exactly, I think, where we could potentially be going forward. So really kind of, you know, down overall, but in some areas, little bit more positivity than others.
So how are we meeting demand?
Lower inputs and higher weights, and so overall that value can be there, but really we just need fewer of them, you know, for placing or harvesting at higher weights. And to kind of give you an example, I mean, we're about 20 to 25 pounds above where we were at in harvest weights last year, and really above our 5-year average. And this year for harvest weights has been really kind of unusual, just because it's not followed seasonal trends. But assuming, which is a big assumption, if we were to continue to follow what we normally expect, which is rising harvest weights in the fall for steers, we'd be at about 960 pounds, which would be very, very large. And really where we're thinking about how much to push those feeder cattle or the fed cattle weights up, really, I think, is going to depend on a lot of those discounts that feedlots are going to start receiving for cattle that are plus 1,000 on the carcass weight.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In terms of wheat, I guess it was relatively weaker based on the Canadians posting what's their grain stocks numbers are, basically.
Bob Mowers with Manduka Trading in Chicago.
All wheat stocks as of the end of July were reported at about 4.583 million metric tons. That is above the USDA's latest estimate of the old crop wheat stocks, and also above the previous number from WASDE. So that is kind of interesting that they see their ending stocks growing. So that obviously adds to supply, which could put a little pressure on prices, right? They also put the canola estimated ending stocks a bit higher than previous numbers too. So in terms of oilseeds and wheat, it looks like things are growing there in terms of actually what's in the, you know, what's in the bins, shall we say. So those are two pressure points, and I think soybeans kind of shrugged that off today, but the wheat futures, being with the hard red winter wheat down about a penny and a half and the hard red spring down about seven, probably saw that as an impediment to move higher, even though corn was able to post a modest gain and soybeans were also the gain on the day too. So that's kind of what's happening there with wheat. I guess the one thing that is kind of bullish for wheat, kind of counteracts that data from Canada, was that ICAR lowered their Russian wheat crop production estimate to about 82.2 million tons. That's down from 83.8 in their previous forecast. And they also lowered exports about a half a million metric tons to about 44 million metric tons. So in terms of the size of the crop there in Russia, and also the pressure points in terms of them, you know, exporting the numbers that had been indicated before, at least from ICAR, you know, maybe that we don't see that kind of pressure here in terms of the extra supply to the world that we would have to compete with. So we'll see how that all plays out. Again, kind of big picture stuff, and, you know, the market kind of basically steady plus or minus in wheat today. So we'll see how things evolve over the next couple few days, and I'll get to that report in just a second. As for corn, I don't know really what's driving it of late. I know that we've seen, I mean, beyond what all the available information that we already have is, meaning a big crop, big ending stocks, ample supply usage numbers, or stocks usage numbers, I mean. So in terms of the quantity out there, there seems to be plenty enough around the world at the moment here in the U.S. and elsewhere. One thing that is kind of evolving is the weather. And over the past few weeks, it's been very dry, especially in the eastern Corn Belt, looking at Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, even parts of Iowa, working that way a little bit. So what that's going to do, in my opinion, is kind of take off the top end of the any kind of irrational exuberance in terms of yields. So that might start working its way through the marketplace. Again, crop's pretty much done. There's no doubt about that, but maybe just take a little off the psychology on the high end of the yield. So maybe they'll get a little bit of support to the marketplace there. And in terms of soybeans, I guess we've got to look here and elsewhere in the world. I mean, obviously here I just mentioned the burden from U.S. carryout, so that's a problem. The report that's going to come out soon on the 12th is going to be a field sample report, so it should be a bit more accurate. Yet, trying to forecast the yield at this stage of the growing phase is not an easy thing. So there is going to be some margin of error. So we'll see how it all plays out. And again, we'll look for that report.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
USDA's new farm income forecast for this year has U.S. farmers as a whole making less money than last year. Spiro Stefano runs USDA's Economic Research Service. He told us,
net cash farm income for 2024 is forecast at $154 billion, which is about a 7.2% drop from 2023.
Crop producers being hit the hardest, with the value of their crop production expected to drop this year by over $25.5 billion. But on the livestock side,
animal receipts are going in the other direction. Animal receipts are forecast to increase about 4%.
Add it up, and Spiro Stefano says you have overall farm income this year, net farm income, down from last year by 4.4%, down to $140 billion.
That's still above historical 20-year average.
Gary Crawford, Washington.